From an approaching runoff election to another ongoing special session of the Texas legislature, there's plenty to discuss these days in the world of politics, as we do on Wednesdays in our regular political roundup. And we'll do so today with the help of UH political science lecturer Nancy Sims and Beth Seamus, an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. Nancy, Beth, thanks for making time for us this morning, the day before Thanksgiving.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
As I mentioned, the runoff election is approaching. Early voting begins on Monday for the December 9th runoff. Some of the candidates for Houston mayor picked up some endorsements this week. As Houston Public Media reported, State Senator John Whitmire in a social media post Tuesday announced former Houston mayoral candidate Jack Christie is endorsing him, and he got the endorsement of former Houston Mayor Anise Parker. Meanwhile, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, along with Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner, have all endorsed Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Do these endorsements tell us anything about these candidates or where this race is headed?
I think endorsements say a lot about where voters can identify with people they've previously admired. But I don't think in this election they're going to have a huge influence because people really know these two candidates already. They've been in public office for, you know, a majority of the electorate's life.
Right.
So people really know them, and I don't think they have as much influence.
Yeah.
And I think it highlights somewhat of a divide I think I've seen in this campaign and between these two candidates. If, you know, you see an endorsement like Hillary Clinton where, you know, it seems like that might be a good thing. But I think that also, again, highlights maybe some of the sentiment that Sheila Jackson Lee's focus has been outside of Houston, has been more on Washington versus Houston, whereas you see a little bit more of the local endorsements coming in on the Whitmire side and really that he's been a more focused in local politics.
Also, is there a sense that with turnout being so low, it's not a presidential year, these municipal elections, super low turnout, and then this is a runoff for that election? So maybe is it sort of, only people who are well-informed or already have their mind made up are going to be the ones casting their votes in this, and then there's not a lot of people on the fence?
Yeah, exactly. There might be some attempts to try to motivate extra people to get out. I mean, it's what we, you know, activation, not persuasion. You're not going to change a lot of minds, but getting someone that's already predisposed to go out in your favor. And, you know, I don't know that these endorsements really do that for people. It's another signal. If anything, maybe it'll get some people to stay home if they think that that means that the deck is stacked against the candidate they prefer.
As we approach early voting, as I mentioned, and then Election Day, in this runoff, I mean, what else in this campaign, the mayoral race, stands out to you?
Well, there's a lot. I would say the mayoral race is certainly the top, but let's also not forget we have a city controller and 7 council races on this ballot, and everyone is so focused on the mayor's race that we noticed even with an already low turnout, the dropout as you went further down into the council races, the drop-off of voters was significant. So now we have 4 at-large races in a runoff, 3 council districts, and the city controller's race, which are all very important. And also we have to next week on the city council agenda for the first time, a council added agenda item, which passed in the November election, allowing 3 council members to push an item to be on the agenda, which we've never had in Houston. The mayor sets the agenda. So this is huge and significant, but it also makes the role of city council members that much more important. So I guess if I wanted to say something to voters before you go early vote next week, please look beyond the mayor's race to the other 8 races that are really important.
Yeah, the controller's race, we always hear about the financial kind of cliff the city is going to face when some federal funding disappears tied to COVID in the next budget or two. And so that controller is going to be pivotal in that, even though it's not necessarily a flashy position that gets the attention of a mayor's race. Speaking of endorsements, as the Texas Tribune reported, Governor Greg Abbott on Sunday endorsed Donald Trump's comeback campaign for the White House while he was hosting the former president at the Texas-Mexico border. That one wasn't a surprise. Do endorsements like that mean anything?
So normally these endorsements are really important. So there's this period of time between when candidates first announce that they're running for president and we see those first caucuses and primaries, and it's the invisible primary. And it's where the elites are all maneuvering and candidates are lining up their backers and particularly lining up their donors. So in the case of Abbott, it would be signaling to his whole donor network, because we know that he is a strong fundraiser, that, hey, maybe this is our candidate. But why I say normally it would make a bigger difference is that, you know, it doesn't look like Trump is really that threatened in this primary. You know, obviously there's a lot that can happen still, but as we get closer and closer, it is looking like this is going to be Trump's nomination campaign to lose. So in that sense, I don't know how much more one endorsement is actually going to make a difference in that Republican primary.
Mentioning the border, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo and other Texas county judges are asking President Biden to block the state's new immigration law. Senate Bill 4 recently passed the Texas legislature, still hasn't been signed by the governor, but he wrote on social media that he looked forward to doing so. SB 4 allows local and state authorities to arrest people suspected of entering Texas illegally from a foreign country, and also empowers county and state court judges to order their deportation if they're found to be in violation. So makes illegally entering the country a state crime. Enforcement of immigration laws, that's typically the jurisdiction of the federal government. How unprecedented is a law like this?
Well, this law is, in my opinion, headed straight to the courts.
Oh, sure.
Because it definitely questions state rights versus federal. And when you're dealing with the border of the United States, which is also the border for Texas, it's a very complicated issue. So the legislation will go into effect, no question. But you're going to see fairly quickly lawsuits filed.
Yes. So it's not dissimilar from the Arizona law that passed and the case that went before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court sided with the federal government in that case. Of course, I think that was 2012. So we've seen a change in the composition of the court. But I still think that the courts would likely have the slight numbers and would favor federal jurisdiction in this case, just because this is, you know, a longstanding thing and creates just a number of issues. Also thinking about not just a state versus federal, but also in thinking about the civil rights that we have in preserving the rights of anyone, whether they're here legally or not. There are just certain rights that individuals have and are recognized in kind of international law and standing. And so there's that to be considered as well.
So is this another one of those red meat moves for the hard right Republican base, knowing it could very well be challenged and overturned?
Definitely. But in the meantime, for Texas's Latino population, it's a very threatening piece of legislation. And, you know, it basically puts the burden of proof of citizenship onto the individual. So, you know, I've been telling my Latino friends, be sure you're carrying your passport with you, because how do you prove you're a citizen if you get stopped for a traffic stop? So it's a really I'm with Beth. I think the civil rights ramifications of this bill during its early implementation are going to be something we need to watch closely.
The fourth special session of the Texas legislature continues, and as we learned late last week and was reported in the Texas Tribune, the Texas House voted to remove school vouchers from a massive education bill. That outcome was a bit of an embarrassment to Governor Abbott, who spent 7 months lobbying 24 Republicans who signaled opposition to vouchers in April. So is this school vouchers quest over, or will the governor keep calling endless special sessions till he gets what he wants?
It's looking like the special sessions may be coming to an end. So he had initially said that he was going to keep doing this, but you know, we haven't heard that as of late. It's now looking more like the governor and somewhat with the help of Senator Ted Cruz are turning and looking toward the elections coming up, and that that's where they're focusing their effort, endorsing those who supported it and looking to endorse the primary challengers, or even find and support primary challengers for those who oppose that within their own party, though. This is an inter-party battle. So this isn't just, you know, Democrats versus Republicans. This is kind of showing a divide within the Republican Party. So it's a little bit more interesting and different from what we've been seeing.
Is there anything else, now that the school vouchers thing might be dead in the water, anything else you're watching in the fourth special session?
Well, they've done Senate Bill 4, which was the other main thing they set out to do. So the immigration and border control issue. So I think the challenge is they never passed a solid education funding bill. So by taking vouchers out, then they also killed the education funding bill. So teachers are not going to get raises, and it basically stamps a big F on the special sessions we've had this year. If I were the governor, I'd let everybody go home for the holidays and refocus. And then you've got the primaries in March. So as Beth mentioned, I think they're going to try to fight this out at the polls through Republican primaries.
We're just getting started with today's political roundup with the University of Houston's Beth Seamus and Nancy Sims. Up next, we discuss some national headlines in politics as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty, and for Craig Cohen, we're in the middle of our regular Wednesday political roundup today with the help of the University of Houston's Nancy Sims and Beth Seamus. As NPR reported on Tuesday, and we've been hearing this morning, Israel's government says it has approved a deal for a four-day pause in fighting to facilitate the release of some of the approximately 240 hostages seized by Hamas in its deadly attack on Israel on October 7th. The deal was expected to include Israel's release of a number of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. So if this indeed happens and is implemented, are there any political ramifications here in the United States?
Oh, this is a very, very complex issue, obviously. I think the reaction from the White House and from the United States has been very much focused on this idea of hostages and what's going on with civilians and protecting civilians. But I do think that the White House has been pretty careful to try to stay out of the more, like I said, complicated aspects of this, because this really is, I mean, obviously the history of it goes way back, and, trying to toe that line of maintaining support by recognizing, you know, that this is not just a simple matter, and really sticking to this idea of, okay, you know, it's pretty safe to focus on the aspect of what's going on in terms of keeping civilians out of it. And that's a pretty something that most people agree with. And when you see, you know, the footage of babies and orphanages and things like that. But when it comes to the actual conflict and looking forward to resolution, I don't know how much this actually moves the needle, or, you know, leaders are keeping pretty close to the vest because they recognize it is such an explosive issue.
Yeah. Well, speaking of President Biden and his administration, well, Biden himself turned 81 this week. President Biden was the oldest person ever elected and is asking voters to return him to the White House for another term, which, if he were reelected, would bring him to age 86 in office. Now, younger voters were a big part of what got him elected the first time. How much of a role do you think age could play in the 2024 campaign when it maybe didn't necessarily cost him in 2020?
Well, age is an issue in this election. But the thing is that the two leading contenders, Biden and Trump, are of the same age. It's actually quite similar to our mayor's race. You could say people are like, but they're so old. But they're the same. So, I mean, Trump is just 4 or 5 years younger than Biden. So it's not a significant difference. So the age issue is present, but it's present on both sides.
Well,
so,
I think the Republicans are trying to frame it more as, mental acumen and capacity. And so you don't necessarily hear them saying age, but you hear them saying, look, is he really fit? Fitness for office, and trying to compare this difference between Trump and Biden. And so, you know, I think it'll come in that way. But, you know, again, as Nancy was saying, they don't want to draw too much attention to age because Trump is also 77. So, you know, this isn't necessarily something they have a huge advantage on, but really trying to push this idea of fitness for office. You know, one thing that I think it could also do, and it'll be interesting to see what the move is on the Republican side, is put a little bit more of a spotlight on the vice president. While that's maybe a kind of macabre way to think about it, but, you know, when you have people that, I mean, it could happen at any time to anyone, regardless of age, I guess. You know, we have to think of the possibility of is there somebody that's ready to step in? And so that may put more of a focus on the vice presidential candidate. But again, that's somewhat to be seen of what the Republicans are going to do and if they're going to try to make the race about that.
Yeah, you could see a running mate being selected with age as a consideration, younger.
Absolutely.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the presidential race, I mean, we learned this week that Texas State University will hold the first 2024 presidential debate. That debate is scheduled for September 16th, 2024. Will be the first of four for the general election, and the San Marcos School would be the first Texas university to hold a presidential debate. Beyond the momentary spotlight and the prestige of hosting one of these events, are there other benefits universities receive from having them on campus?
Well, sure. I mean, it brings your university into the national media spotlight. So it attracts people to the university itself. It's almost like a great sporting event or having a good football team. It raises the level of presence of your university. And so it's a really significant coup for Texas State. And I think it's a, you know, we'll draw people to San Marcos. Now, we kind of have to remember that back in 2020, San Marcos and the trip from San Marcos to Austin on a bus was the site of one of the Trump supporters attacking a Biden bus that's now been adjudicated and found guilty. So it'll keep San Marcos, which is a relatively small town, in the spotlight nationally.
Yeah, pretty big coup for them ahead of some other bigger name, bigger universities in the state. Well, today, as we've been hearing on NPR, marks the 60th anniversary of the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. That occurred a day after the president attended events in Houston, including meeting with Latino civil rights leaders at the Rice Hotel here in downtown on November 21st, 1963. That's considered a pretty pivotal moment in Mexican-American history. Why?
Well, it's largely regarded as the first time that Mexican Americans were acknowledged in the civil rights battle. That, you know, a lot of the focus was on the South and Black Americans, but here was a president actually meeting with Hispanic leaders, and I believe he spoke Spanish at one point in giving a speech. And this was not something that we'd seen in the 1960s, and so this was kind of a big deal of saying, "Hey, there is this community out there that we need to be paying attention to as well."
We learned earlier this week about the death of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, the wife of former President Jimmy Carter. She was a longtime advocate for mental health issues. She was 96. How much did she change the national dialogue about mental health, do you think?
Well, she started the conversation because up to that point, we didn't talk about it.
Didn't have a dialogue.
We didn't have a dialogue. So the fact that she was willing to talk about it in a time frame that, you know, in my youth, it was very much whispered, so-and-so's mom had a quote-unquote nervous breakdown and was taken down to Galveston, which was like, oh, the worst thing that could happen to a kid. So, you know, when she brought the topic to the forefront, it just started a dialogue for us. But the other aspect of Rosalynn Carter, I think, is really important, was her commitment to caregivers and the people that care for people with special needs and elderly and all of that, because she was a huge supporter and brought that topic to the limelight as well.
Well, lastly, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. This might be the hardest question I ask you today. I know a lot of politics these days pretty exasperating, frustrating, divided, partisan. But is there anything you're thankful for in politics right now? I'll start with Beth.
I'm thankful it's not worse. worse. And I'm not saying that with sarcasm. I'm saying, you know, if we think back through history and we look at what's going on in other countries, and yes, we may be at a point where we're frustrated and we maybe don't have an ideal situation. But, you know, if you look at our history of democracy, it's actually, you know, we're doing okay. Maybe we're being a little hard on ourselves in some ways, and that, you know, like I said, it could be a whole lot worse.
We still have a democracy for the moment.
Right. I'm really thankful for the bright stars on the horizon. When I look at the city elections and I see the controllers race with Chris Hollins, who's a younger candidate, and some of the new city council members that have already been elected and those that are running, you know, I see the bright stars that are coming to take the place of the older leaders that we, as I always joke on here, the boomers are not letting go. So, you know, it's nice to, hey, the Rolling Stones are back in Houston in April. Right. You know, boomers just won't quit. But and I see it in the coming congressional races. I see it in the state rep races. We're starting to see the next generation of candidates stepping up to the plate. And I'm really thankful for that.
We're thankful for both of you making time for us today. Nancy Sims is a political science lecturer at the University of Houston, where Beth Seamus is an associate professor of political science. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Thank you. You too, Mike.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving.